Sometimes we try to mix things up a little bit. And we've been journeying for, 2 weeks? This is our third. In the season of Lent, and dwelling on the 23rd Psalm that that David wrote. It starts with the famous words, "The Lord is my shepherd." Okay, and so we've been exploring what the in-depth reality of that phrase means. Follows it with, "I have all I need," or "I lack nothing." So what does it look like to have that kind of connection with God, and what does it mean for God to have that character? So I've been kind of leading us through some things, and this week, as Dwayne and I were talking, two things came up. Number one, I have 4 weeks left in my master's degree, and it's it doesn't feel like something to celebrate at the moment. And so some weeks where the workload is particularly heavy, I get a chance to dwell on the content of the passages that we're looking at, but not always the structure of how we go about it, okay? And the second thing is that we really like the chance to have kind of dialogue together. And so as Dwayne and I were talking about it, he said, "Well, why don't we just do this thing where kind of I'll throw you some ideas and you run with it, and then you can help guide the structure for me, as well as the fact that that when we talk together about some of these passages, there's an enlightening opportunity that comes with it." So we're kind of excited about doing that. And
Yeah, so my goal is twofold. Number one is to kind of give you guys a glimpse. Some of you know this. Keith and I meet once a week for a couple hours, and we sort of hash through this stuff and talk through this stuff. And very frequently during those meetings, I often wish, man, you know, it'd be kind of cool if people could sort of get a glimpse of that, because, you know, not everything we talk about always makes it into Sunday and stuff. So that's kind of cool. That's the number one goal. My number two goal is to keep him seated.
Oh,
so
boy.
We're going to try to keep him in his chair.
I already have the whiteboard out, so.
All right.
We'll see how that works.
So, Keith, we have been journeying through this idea of the Lord is my shepherd, the 23rd Psalm. And I think one of the fascinating things that comes up week after week is that what we think we understand about it isn't necessarily always what a shepherd might have understood about it, or what David might have understood about these words.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a twofold thing. Number one, we have no understanding of what the shepherding realities were in ancient Palestine. So we don't know what it was like for a shepherd to live on these fields. We don't have the cultural reality. I don't know if any of you have, you know, like gone by a shepherd on your morning commute to work lately, but it's just not a part of our current cultural reality. So that's number one. And then number two, we're talking about Hebrew language. So we're talking about a poem that is written in a different language that people always try to interpret as best they can, but then we get all these different words.
Right. So as this ancient Hebrew shepherd, David, writes the words that we are going to talk about today, he, the Lord, my shepherd, he mm-hmm. guides me.
Right.
Like, what? Let's start there. Let's start with just the very first passage. What does it mean for a shepherd to guide sheep, and what might we extrapolate from that?
Well, so it's really difficult to guide a sheep. So Bethany, my wife, when she was a teenager, she lived in a bit of a rural area, and one of her friends was involved in the 4-H club. Do they even have those in Delaware?
Yeah.
Do they? Okay, good. All right. So you're familiar. I'm only in the northern Delaware area most of the time.
What do the 4-H's stand for, Keith?
Oh, dude. Home, heart,
okay.
Health. And hogs? Okay,
that's
so
good enough.
Anyways, so they show the animals that they've been working on, okay? And so, you know, like you've seen the show dogs where they, you know, you train the dogs and they go inside all these cones and then they run up and over the bridge and they jump and they grab this. So to show a sheep, do you know what you have to do? You literally just have to get it to walk from one place to another. So that's all you do. Sheep are so stubborn that to succeed at showing a sheep, you just have to get the stupid thing to just walk in a straight line, okay? And so Bethany joined her friend, and her friend gave her like the leash or whatever a sheep thing is that stays connected. And Bethany said that as soon as she started walking, the sheep just dug its feet in. And she said, "These things are so heavy, and you're just yanking at it, and it's not going anywhere." And so to guide a sheep is a real artful task. It requires something of skill in the shepherd. And so pulling and dragging isn't exactly the image that we get for this word for guides. It's the word, which is naha, is the same word that is used when, in the Old Testament, in the Exodus, when the people of Israel are given God's presence by a pillar and a cloud. Are you familiar with this story? That there's a cloud that leads them by day, and a pillar of fire by night when they're walking through the wilderness. And that the pillar guides them. So that's the same word that we have here. And remember, David knew all of this. This was his story. Okay? And so David uses the same word that's used to talk about something that lights the way in such a direction that it gives you enough direction, but also enough attractiveness that you want to follow, that you want to go behind it. It lights the direction for you, but it's also something that you can feel like you trust. So when there's a guidance, God guides us or guides us along. We'll get to that next phrase. When we're talking about guidance, we're not talking about God forcing anything. And we're talking about something that's beautiful and unique. One of the things that you see in shepherding stories also, we're probably getting ahead of it, but let's just talk about it here, is that one of the problems with sheep is because they just will follow the leader wherever the sheep in front of them goes, they get stuck in these ruts. Okay, and so what they do is they just wear down the same path over and over and over and over again. That's the next phrase. Let's do the next phrase.
Yeah, well, actually, I want to follow up on that second. Because I think about, you know, we're Americans, and so we're more like cowboys than like shepherds.
Yeah.
Right? And as I'm reading this, I'm imagining...
I don't like cowboys.
Well, we're right. I mean, the idea is you...
I'm an Eagles fan.
I know you're an Eagles fan, but that's okay. I'm from Texas, so some of us like cowboys. No, I shouldn't have said that. But the idea that... Like cowboys, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a cowboy, but I've seen enough movies to know that, like, you know, you chase the cattle, right? You ride the horse around. Sometimes you have dogs that nip at the cattle,
right.
And you're forcing them into a direction.
Yeah, right.
You're making them go somewhere.
And don't we talk about God like this sometimes?
We absolutely do.
Yeah,
the place God is
going to send me is the place that I least want to go. Friends, we've got to really be careful about the language that we use when we talk about that sort of a thing. Some of us have been around Christian culture where it's just normal to talk like that. And yes, sometimes God redeems situations, but usually when you end up there, it's because God's been changing and shifting you in such a way that you desire. You hear like missionaries, well, I wouldn't do anything but go to Africa, and then God sent me to Africa, as if God's corralling me there, versus the fact that, but as I opened myself up to God, God started to transform my heart, and I started to fall in love with a people and a place. We really have to be careful, because what we make is, for the outside world looking in, we make this image of God that is the one who forces us to go into places that we don't want. That is completely different than God transforming us and creating such an attractive way of life that even laying our lives down for others becomes the best way and the most desirable, and we are following that pillar of light. That's a totally different glimpse. Which one do you want to follow? The one that's got a taser behind you, right? Or the God that creates such a beautiful light into such a world of fulfillment that it would be silly to want to go in any other direction.
Yeah, so if we get that idea in our head that our shepherd is guiding us in that way, in a gentle, invitational sort of way.
Right.
Sort of the next phrase, the two parts of the next phrase is paths of righteousness, or sometimes right paths.
Right paths, yeah.
So let's talk about the paths.
Let's just do the paths, yeah. So here's what I was saying earlier. So in a shepherding world, like I mentioned, sheep just want to follow the exact same path, and they wear down ruts. And if any of you are hikers or hunters maybe, and you follow like deer paths or you follow well-worn paths, you know that one of the risks is that as a path becomes more and more worn, erosion starts, right? And it gets really, really narrow. And so there's problems if the path for a shepherd becomes too worn. Number one, it actually literally gets dangerous. It becomes this very narrow, deep thing, and sheep can break their ankles on it while they're trying to go through it. But the other thing is that sheep won't, they'll just take what's easiest and most available to them. So they'll begin grazing right along the path. And if you follow the same path over and over and over again, what they end up doing is they end up eating the grass all the way down to the dirt, and then they paw at the dirt and pull it up and actually eat the roots. And what they end up doing is they end up burning the ground. And so the grass can't even grow again. Sorry, I'm supposed to say seed. So the grass can't grow again. And so they actually damage the same place that could be nourishment to them because they're always doing the exact same thing over and over again. And so the Philip Keller, in his book about shepherding, as he looks at this 23rd Psalm, he says that his primary, when he was a shepherd in Israel, his primary goal was that he had to keep the sheep moving and that the path was never straight. Isn't that interesting? He said the solution was that we always have to keep the sheep on the move to get to new pastures and new places to feed, but that you couldn't go in a straight line because that would get burned down. And so what you would do is you would wind all the way around.
Yeah, and you were sharing with me a story of a rabbi who had sort of an anecdote about the short.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is that, and the fun thing about studying the Old Testament scriptures is that you get the rabbi's inputs. And my gosh, I mean, Jesus makes me not want to ever be Jewish, but I love rabbis. I absolutely love the way that they teach. That didn't sound right. Because of Jesus, I am a Christian, not Jewish.
Understood.
Okay. In case there were any questions out there. But so anyways, what ends up happening is they interpret this verse because of a couple things as he leads me or guides me in the circuitous paths of righteousness. And because the nature of that word path is not a straight arrow. It's a winding thing. And so they look at the shaping and the soul shaping that happens. And I think the quote I wrote down here. So Harold Kushner, who's a rabbi, he tells this riddle. And there's a young student that asks, is there a shortcut to this location? Okay, he asks his rabbi, is there a shortcut to this location? And the rabbi responds, there's a shortcut that is long, and there is a long way that is short. There's a shortcut that's long, and there's a long way that's short. So the fastest and most direct way to something might get you there quicker, but in the end, it's a longer path than what we might say the scenic route. Yeah. Why do we call it the scenic route? Yeah. Because there's something restorative of doing the long way around, right? There's something about a highway that's different than a country road.
Yeah. That, you know what that reminds me of is the contemplative practice of walking a labyrinth.
Yes.
I remember at one point in my life sort of walking, doing this labyrinth in sort of a really meditative way. If you're not sure what a labyrinth is, it's kind of like almost like a maze, except there's only one path. And you've sort of seen the ornamented maybe 7-circuit or 11-circuit labyrinths like at the Cathedral in Chartres. And one of the fascinating things that I remember
like
coming to...
Like at the Cathedral in Chartres. Like we've seen
yeah,
it.
Sure. You've been there.
Dwayne is a classical musician who travels to places like France. Sorry. So no, we haven't seen that.
You haven't seen that. If I'd have thought ahead, I would have put a picture up. You would probably know what it looks like. But anyway, you're walking this path, and it is a circuitous path.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about it is the goal, sort of the goal, quote unquote, of the labyrinth is to get to the center and then to get back out again. And what's fascinating about the way the path is designed is there are moments where you go, like at the very beginning, you'll go very close to the center. And you're weaving around this path, and you think you're almost at the center, but you've got a long way to go because you have to work your way back out and back around and back through. And so the idea of the short way that is long, to me, is one of those things that if you allow God to guide you, the shepherd that is guiding you along the paths, you may not feel like you're getting to the goal, the location right away.
Yeah.
But I think God, at least in my mind, I'm thinking of it this way, that God is sort of guiding you along this path that is best for you. That is helping you find, the right path, the righteousness, right? And then
Miley Cyrus must have been reading the 23rd Psalm. She said, "It's
I
it's
bet
the
she
climb,
was
right.
It's the climb, climb. Yeah."
But there is this idea. I think
did
she
really
sing
just
that?
Quote did Miley Cyrus?
I hope not. Can we edit?
No, she said it. Yeah,
can we
can
edit
that
our
out.
Recording. Yeah, she's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
So, anyways, so
moving on. This is the long way that is short.
So I think the important thing to know is that the path that David is talking about is not the kind of direct, easy, straight, and narrow. It's that God often guides us and leads us into soul-shaping experiences, not forcing, not bringing like evil our way. Gosh, we have to get away from. This is an aside, but we've got to get away from language that acts like God gave a loved one cancer so that he could teach me patience. I mean, do we have any understanding how damaging that is to people to suggest that God's that petty? That might offend some of you. But we have to talk rightly about God, and the idea of what God guides us through is God is never the author of evil.
Yeah.
God is never the author of hardship. But God walks with us on life's journey, and often as he guides us and shapes us, he uses all of our mistakes, he uses all the brokenness and all of the hang-ups and all of the problems and all of the barriers that we face to shape us and redeem. And I think that that's a really crucial part of all of this. But the path that we're talking about, according to shepherds and according to the language itself, is not always an easy path, but it takes us into places where there's nutrients in beautiful ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the second part of that phrase is really important.
This is the fun part.
Paths of righteousness.
Yeah.
And it's translated two ways, right? So some translations will say he leads me along right paths,
mm-hmm.
and some will say he leads me or guides me along the paths of righteousness. So
right.
talk a little bit about that
yeah.
word right or righteous and what's
so this is really, really interesting. So the word I'm going to use the whiteboard. The word righteous is the Hebrew word tzedek, okay? And that means when we think about righteous, we often think about kind of holy. If you're righteous, you're like, you don't make a lot of mistakes and stuff like this. That's not the core root of the word righteous. The core root of the word righteous is about mercy and justice. In fact, in the Hebrew Old Testament, in the Torah, it's most often translated as justice or compassion or mercy. In fact, the Jewish people have a practice of almsgiving that they must care for the poor. It's not an option if you are Jewish and you are a faithful Jewish person. By the way, the same is true of Christians. But if you are a faithful Jewish person, you have to care for the poor. It's a part of the core. And the name for that, that practice is called tzedekah. Just add an A-H. And that's literally charity is how it's often interpreted. But here's the point. When David's talking about this, the right, why it's translated as righteousness is because it is right ways of living in the most full sense. So the word tzedek is a, it's the word image is that of a scale, okay? So when we think of a scale, that's why justice has the scale, right? It's because of this. This is the root word. Tzedek means righteousness or justice. So doesn't like the Justice Department, isn't that a thing? That like an image of a scale or something? Okay, good. Also looks like a big happy face. So anyways, so what we get is the word righteous means right for all, right ways of living. God guides us on ways of living that what is right for you is right for me. And this is incredibly important. There's a balance. That's why some of the rabbis talk about the circuitous path. He guides me on the circuitous path of righteousness. In Deuteronomy, I want to say, chapter 16, I think. I've got a slide for it. But in Deuteronomy chapter 16, there's one of the primary passages for the Jewish people. And it's at the beginning of talking about God appointing judges. And it says, tzedek, tzedek, tirdach. And that means righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue. And it's listed twice in that passage. And once again, David would have had this memorized without question. Righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue. Justice, justice shall you pursue. And what that means, according to the rabbis, is you have to pursue righteousness righteously. There is a way, I don't know if it's on there or not, there is a way to pursue righteousness unrighteously. The modern day example that rabbis tell is someone wants to get up early and pray and develop a routine. But they put the alarm clock in the middle of the house and it wakes up everybody else at the same time. That's pursuing righteousness unrighteously, the rabbis say. There is a way that we can seek out what we feel like is best for us, but it either damages or ignores another. Okay? This is where the chewing on the grass becomes really interesting. Because what's happening is while the sheep are trying to get nourishment, they're actually damaging the land that they're a part of. It's not righteous for the land. Now, we can use that as a metaphor for a whole bunch of things. The way that Christians often want to pursue personal holiness, but we ignore the cause and the need of the widows and the orphans that are so central in all of the time that Jesus spent telling us to care for people who are in need and who are suffering. But we can also translate it directly and say that often our way of life is very maybe personally holy, but we're damaging our earth in the midst of caring for what God's given us in terrible ways. So we might say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, but we are actually a part of all sorts of series of systems of exploitation that we're not even aware of. And some of it's impossible to get away from. If you use a cell phone, you know, cell phones come from chemicals on other continents that are not healthy to be producing. But most of us, you know, I need to communicate with people. And like, it's messy. It's messy. But the point here is that that the circuitous path of righteousness, God guiding us along right paths, is a part of God's shalom plan, a part of the idea that when God leads us in a direction, he is leading us in a direction where we are part of the redemption and reconciliation of the whole world. It's not about what we're not doing, which is what Dallas Willard calls the gospel of sin management. That many Christians buy into the idea that the good news is that I don't sin. That's the end goal of this game. The end goal of this game is that I'm not doing anything wrong. Okay? Which, therefore, any inanimate object can be an excellent Christian. Right? This is from the very legalist, you know, don't smoke, drink, or chew, and don't date those that do. Right? This idea of the ideal Christian is just someone who sits around and doesn't make a mistake. But that is not what right paths are about. Not then and not now. What right paths are about is about God guiding us in such a way that as we live righteously in a personal way, as we live the right ways, we are also making the ways right in the world. This is what God's leading us to. So it's not about correct. We read this, God guides me in right paths, and we think that means like God guides me in the correct way to go. That's true, but in a much broader term than we think. It's true because it means that God guides us toward wholeness and redemption of all things. Our earth, our relationships with other people, our reconciliation and relationship with God, all of that is wrapped up into what it means to be guided along right paths. So it's not about closing my eyes and saying, all right, I don't know where to go. God, tell me if I'm supposed to eat Cheerios or Fruit Loops this morning. God will guide me along the right paths. There's a place for discernment and Spirit-led specific direction. But what paths of righteousness are about is about the way that God opens doors for us to participate in the making right of all things. And it's personal within our own hearts and our lives and our own morality. And it's social in terms of how we care and love other people and make sure that we are participating in that. So what's right for you should be right for me.
Yeah, and I think what's challenging about that is just our inherent competitiveness.
Yes!
People, we're always seeking to
thank you.
To win. We want to do, like you were talking about the gospel of sin management, I want to do better and I want to do best. And we even compete, honestly, we even compete with one another for God's favor in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I want to be, you know, better or more righteous or whatever. And one of the powerful things, somebody even just shared it in a prayer about the sort of the damage that some churches do. And I think inadvertently, churches and Christians can damage other people by pursuing righteousness in a way that belittles others or that wounds others or injures others or eats all the grass on the path and there's no nourishment left for others.
Yeah.
Right?
The core value and hope of the scriptures is cooperation.
Yeah.
Of us partnering with God to make all things right. And the core sin is competition. The core sin is I want to know more than God. You know, that's the Genesis story. I want to know more than God desires to give us. I want to make all my own decisions. I can do this better than you, God. I know that you put limitations on. No, I'm not interested in that. You know, and Cain and Abel, you know, like one, whose is better? Whose offering is better? And jealousy. Competition is our sin. We look at other people as competitors when God creates us to be in cooperation and partnership with one another and with him.
And that is so powerful to me to think about. The right paths for me, the paths of righteousness, are not only going to be right for me, they're going to be right for everyone else.
Well,
it's going to bring everybody together.
Yeah. So let's talk about all the clothes outside.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so yesterday we did this event that we call the swap and drop, and what we had is literally we gave away hundreds of bags full of clothing yesterday, and we still have probably 100 left over here that we're going to, that you're all going to help us clean up at the conclusion of our gathering. But here's the thing. Some of you, thank you, spent long days yesterday sorting clothes, welcoming people, getting everything on the tables. It's this giant free thrift store for a day. And here's the thing. That was taxing for some of you. Some of you, like me, went home yesterday and you were tanked. You were exhausted. You spent yourself. But you also participated in something really beautiful. You helped people who needed clothes get them. You helped keep clothes out of a landfill and put them back into usage in the world so that we have less waste. You created a space for people to find value and connection where no money was changing hands. We did something beautiful, and the trade-off there is what was good for you, even if it exhausted you, even if you spent a lot of time and energy, even if you were dead tired at the end of the day. There is something that God does when you realize what's up, what happened, what we're participating in, that is as fulfilling for us as it is for them. For the people who were in desperate need who came in, and I knew at least two people came in saying, I have no idea where I'm going to find clothing for my children. Last time we did this, one grandmother said, Mom just left. She just ran out of the picture, and I inherited four of my grandchildren that are living with me now, and I have no clothes for any of them, and I have no idea what to do, but I'm the only thing they've got. I found out last week. thanks for having this. Like this is about making in a tiny, tiny little way, making the world right. It's small, but that's a part of this whole process. It's all interconnected. But what's right for others is often right for us. It's not the self-giving life is how you find your life, right? You give it away. And when we give our lives away, other people are lifted up, other people are loved, other people are cared about, but it's good for us and it's good for them.
And what's amazing about that is it's not only good for us and good for them, but as the rest of this verse says, it's also good for God, right?
Yes.
When we are led along these paths of righteousness, it brings honor to the name of God.
Yeah. So God gets a good reputation when what's good for us is good for others. When we live lives of righteousness for his name's sake, means that as we live in such a way as God has created us to live, we make God look good. We have the chance to make God look good. And you might say, well, God doesn't need us to look good. I'm not sure I agree with that. God has given the church the responsibility to represent Jesus in the world. And as much as we want to say that people should not judge Christianity based on Christians, which I'm like, true, that's not going to stop the fact that they will. People will look at you and how you follow Jesus, and they will make a judgment call about the nature and character of God, whether you think that's fair or true or not. So we have a responsibility here to make God's name great, to make God's name as winsome as we believe Jesus actually is. And the name, of course, is more than just the name of Jesus, right?
Right.
You want to talk about that a little bit, about what names mean?
Well, like, what do you mean? The idea of...
The idea of God's name and what that actually represents in the name of Jesus. What does
that
mean?
Well, just the idea of that a name is a person's entire essence. It's their character. And so, particularly in Old Testament, you know, when you talk about invoking the name of someone else, you're representing that person. You're being sort of an ambassador of who they are and what they are about. And so whenever the name of God is invoked, it's much more than just, you know... I'm talking about God. It's if I say I'm in. This is in the name of Yahweh. This is a big deal. So being a representative of God, being the embodiment of His character and who He is, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, in the Ten Commandments in Exodus, don't take the Lord's name in vain. Yeah. Contrary to popular belief, does not mean don't say "Oh God." I don't think that's a particularly helpful phrase because I don't know why you'd want to insert God as a swear word. However, what it actually means is don't bear the character of God without integrity. That's what "don't take the Lord's name in vain" means.
Don't take on
the name of the Lord and then act nothing like Jesus. What are you doing? You're giving God a bad reputation. Come on, knock it off.
Yeah.
You know. And so granted, we are. By the way, and this goes back to what Jess shared. The answer is not perfectionism here. The answer is authenticity. So we're open about our brokenness and our imperfections and our ongoing struggle and need to trust God. That makes God look good because we believe that God's a redemptive, forgiving, loving God. It's not as if, oh crap, I have to make God look good so I'm not able to ever make a mistake. Good grief. None of us can survive that. But I understand that as someone who bears the name of Jesus, you know, and that was in the early world, you know, a little Christ was an insult. And Christians were like,
We like it.
Yeah, let's stick with that. You know, I think that's pretty good image for us to be little Christs in the world because of what Jesus did. And so we take that and unashamedly, you know, we bear that. And then Matthew talks about that in a beautiful way. You know, when Jesus is talking with his disciples, he says, "You're light of the world." And what that means is that you do beautiful, good things in the name of God, unashamedly, that Jesus is your motivator for living the way you do. And then other people see that. And then God gets the credit because it makes God look better. Because then we're giving people a realistic glimpse of who God actually is.
Would you say, and again, I don't want to get into the area of absolutes because there's always wiggle room and gray area and stuff. But would you say that it's almost somewhat of a litmus test to say that if I feel like God is calling me to follow this certain path, but I know, I can see that path is going to be damaging to other people? Can we begin to question that then and say maybe this is not the path God is calling me?
Yeah, I mean, there's gray areas,
of course,
right?
Gray,
you know,
area,
like because if someone's oppressing somebody, what's good for the oppressed is going to be bad for the oppressor. You
of
know,
course,
when Jesus
sure.
casts out a demon and it ends up costing the people who were using her as a fortune teller, this woman, right? They're ticked off at him. And so it wasn't good for them.
Right.
So it's not going to be good sometimes for people who are doing evil. That doesn't mean that we kill those evil people, sure, right? Jesus has pretty strong words about how we treat our enemies. But yeah, I think that we need to be aware that, you know, what's the idea of justice is that we are partnering with God to make the world as it should be.
Yeah.
And if we are damaging somebody else, we need to look at that and think through that.
So looking at how our following of Jesus impacts other people around us and looking at how our following Jesus reflects on the name and the character of God.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's important. And for many of us that have come through some pretty damaging church experiences or have seen Christian faith lived out in ways that lack integrity or have seen how Christian faith has become linked to this American civil religion that we see in politics and in our world when we look at Christianity on the television that looks nothing like Jesus. You know, many of us are like, well, I just maybe want to give up that whole name of Jesus thing, you know? St. Francis of Assisi, preach the gospel at all times, use words when necessary. He never said that. He believed in preaching like crazy. That's a wrong quote. The essence of it might be good, that we need to understand that our lives should be a message to people, that when people interact with us, they should at least in some small way walk away feeling like what people felt like in the presence of Jesus. That's a strong statement.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think it's true. I think when people interact with us, they should get some sense of value, of care, of being fully present, of concern, of a desire to make things right. They should sense that in the tiniest little interactions with us because we are representing Jesus. But we need to be unashamed about our faith. That's how we redeem the church, friends. So many of us are like, oh, the Christian movement in the United States, it's just ugly. It doesn't look a lot like Jesus. Well, don't stop connecting with Jesus or publicly because of that. What you can do is you can be a part of redeeming it. When we started LifePath, there was a lot of people that had baggage with the church and the organized religion.
Right.
And so we were like, should we call ourselves LifePath Collective? LifePath Community? You know, what should we do? And we're like, no, we are a church and we want to be a part of redeeming what it means to be God's church in the world as a loving, welcoming, you know, place where anybody can come in and experience the love of God. And that's what's transformative. Yeah. And so we need to be unafraid, and that's hard. You know,
it
doesn't mean that you lead by saying, you know, just so you know, I bake these cookies because I'm a Christian, you know, but it also means we need to be unashamed of the fact that we walk with Jesus on a daily basis and that Jesus is the one that's teaching us and shaping us.
And that can be challenging,
totally.
I think, for any of us who, and we talked about this on Tuesday where, and as a former pastor, I know what you were saying, when it's sometimes it's a little bit easier
you're
almost when you're a
pastor. Too.
Well, okay, I'm sorry. I am a current pastor. I was a former full-time pastor where it was my full-time job. And so as a pastor, you can lead with that and say, well, this is my job. This is what I do.
Yeah, it's easier for me.
Right?
You know, what do you do? I'm a pastor. Oh, and then I can read people and it gives me a chance to break down stereotypes or whatever.
Right.
It's
but
actually
for those
easier,
of us who work in public arenas and public venues or state universities or whatever, you know, you can't always lead with that and say, well, I'm a Jesus follower. And so that impacts everything I do. And so sometimes you're aware that there are people in your sphere of influence who have baggage with the church or maybe have rejected what they believe to be, you know, Jesus or Christianity or the church. And so it is challenging because you always want to be aware, good, what's good for me has to be good for them too. I want to portray and paint a good picture of what it means to follow Jesus, but I want to do that in a way that doesn't make them immediately discount anything else I have to say and offer, right?
Yeah, I think there might be two ways to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's more than that, but things that are popping up in my head. One is that we maybe need to be prepared to live more questionable lives.
I love that phrase.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And that comes from Mike Frost, who's an Australian theologian. So he says, our lives should be so questionable, they should be peculiar, that people look at the way that we live and they say, well, that's odd.
Yeah.
You know? We joke around about, you know, to meet our neighbors when we moved into our house. We just started having Chinese takeout dinners on a blanket in our front yard right in front of the sidewalk because we live beside a park and everybody walks past us to get to the park.
Yeah.
So we just had a picnic in the front yard and said hi to people and asked if we could pet their dogs.
That's kind of weird.
Yeah. And people said, hi, you guys. Yeah, that's cool. They usually say, that's cool. You're having dinner. We really value loving our neighbors and meeting our friends. And often that, oh, cool, you just moved here? Yeah, well, here's our story a little bit. So that's one thing. I think that we need to be willing to live questionable lives just a little bit more. And we need to realize that your story, okay, is not offensive to people.
Right. Right.
Like when we're talking about owning our faith, it doesn't mean to say what you have to do. It means being unashamed of the fact that Jesus has transformed me. I can say, if you're outside of Christian faith and even a bit skeptical,
And
I say, yeah, Jesus has transformed me. You can't say, no, he hasn't.
Right.
Right? You can say you don't believe in all sorts of things, but my own journey of transformation and how I'm growing and learning, that's not something that's debatable. And so it's very non-confrontational, you know, to just talk about, God's been teaching me that lately. That's such a simple, no, he hasn't. Like, no, like that's not how people respond in this world. We make these straw man, ideas of what people think about that are outside of the faith.
And a lot of that, a lot of that comes from the idea that you know, we talk about it as post-enlightenment, sort of like thinking we have to be rational, and the rationality is we have to convince someone of some objective truth.
Yeah, but that's totally changing.
And that's totally
the
changing,
the culture
because
is
it's
shifting
But we in the church have sort of been, a lot of us who've grown up in the church have sort of been trained up under that idea of like, if I want someone else to believe in Jesus or to follow Jesus, I have to convince them of these seven objective truths and let them give mental assent to that. But if you tell your own story and invite someone into that story, that's a totally different
way. Our world is more open to the mystical and the spiritual than at any time in any one of our lives. The world is more open to it. It's just that they're pursuing lots of other ways because of what the Enlightenment did. And so Christian faith isn't the number one way that people are pursuing connection with God.
Right.
But they're still pursuing connection with God. It's just sometimes through like werewolves and vampires and stuff like that. And so we shouldn't be afraid of those things. We should say, that's a longing. You know, just look at how many shows and movies these days deal with the supernatural. That's an expression of people's longing to play with the idea that there's something more out there.
Right.
And when that something more is actually a person that embodies the trueness and the fullness of God and teaches us how to love well with one another, forgive each other, care for the poor, make things right in the world, that's the best option, folks. You know? That's Jesus is the best option, you know, and to the heart of God, the trueness and the fullness of it. And so God guides us in these paths of learning how to live in the truest way that we are designed to live. And it brings joy to us and fulfillment to us. It meets the needs of others at the same time. And by doing that, we build up the beauty of the reputation of God.
That's a great summary. That's what I was going to say. Just summarizing that verse. Is there anything we missed? Anything that you just feel burning like?
I don't think so.
Okay.
One thing that I would want to say. And that's this idea of, did I put the 1 John passage in here? Yeah. Yeah. You know, the challenge, when we think about like making the world right, like it has to be movement, right? I talked about how Philip Keller said that the key to the shepherd was moving. There's got to be some movement in our lives that's related to this. It's great if you feel super compassionate, if you're on Facebook and you see all these causes and you feel, but I would take someone who feels less compassionate about everything and does something about one thing any day. Like, where's the fire in your belly that Jesus has placed there when you look around the world? What is the path that you just long for the world to be right in? Is it children without parents? Is it orphans? Adopt a kid. Support an adoptive family. Is it families who don't have a home? Get involved in our Family Promise Compassion Team. Is it children from broken families? Start mentoring here with us. Is it something else? You know, just do something. I think we get paralyzed because we think we have to do everything to make things right. You know, just do something. Move. You know, and just choose something and sense, okay, God, what are you leading me toward? Yeah. So I think that's just an important part because we can talk about God making the world right and it feels so big, you know? So what path is God guiding you toward and leading? What sounds like incredibly nourishing to you? Oh, I would love it. Like some people are like, you know, Jess and I, we talk sometimes about her work as a therapist. Like she's working with these families. For her, that's part of her calling. And to be honest, like spending the evening serving more homeless families is often really, really difficult to do because this is there. Now, for some of us who might spend our days in an office, the idea of spending an evening caring and serving homeless families and giving them food, that's like, oh, it's so fulfilling. I want to do something. Yes.
Right, yeah.
And so, like, that's great. It's okay that we have different directions and things. What is good for you that will be good for other people, too? It's a great question. What do you find fulfilling and get excited about? Not like, oh, that sounds like a ton of work.
And I just want to follow up on your comment that it often feels overwhelming. And I've been in several churches, this one included, where we talk a lot about finding your call mm-hmm. or finding where you are meant to serve in the world. And we talk about that as reconnecting people to God's redemptive work in the world. And oftentimes it can feel overwhelming if you don't know what's my thing, like what is my big life mission or call. But I think what you're talking about, Keith, is the idea of movement, tiny little steps in any one direction
yeah.
can take you down that path. And maybe you get involved in one thing right now, but that leads you to an awareness of a deeper longing of your heart, and that can take you. And the path is circuitous. The path is long and winding. I was trying to figure out a way to get the Beatles song wrapped in here, the long and winding road. But yeah, the path is long and winding, and sometimes it doesn't feel like you're getting to that ultimate destination of figuring out what your life is meant to be.
It's the climb, baby.
But it's the climb, yeah. Okay, I'm going with the Beatles. You're going with Miley Cyrus. I think that says something about the two of us. No, I'm just kidding.
Clearly. Clearly, I'll let you decide what that says.
Yeah.
It says that you're old, and I'm completely up and hip and with the times.